Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.
They even had a scene where they said, "We had a whole funeral for you," and Matt Damon says, "What was in the coffin?"
There is. Yes.
No, I'm joking.
Absolutely.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region. No guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Here he is, the one and only winner of the Gemini Crockett Contest. This boy is fueled
like fire.
So start melting, ladies, because the boy is hotter than hot. He's hot,
hot, hot.
The right size, right build, right head.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Wreckatopia, episode 179. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Super Greenerinos.
That's right. Mm. And welcome, Jeremy Scott.
Hello.
That's right. Today's big recommend is The Fifth Element from 1997. Can't wait to get into that. We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you so much, chat, for coming out here. We appreciate it. Let's get into our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And Aaron, what do you got?
I'm going to talk about the highest grossing animated film of all time, the fifth highest grossing film of all time. That's right. I'm going to talk about Naja 2.
That's correct.
I'm aware that this exists, but it boggles my mind that that it's a sequel. Go ahead.
It has made $2.2 billion worldwide gross. And I wanted to see what all of the fuss was about. I did watch the original, Naja, before, which is 2019, I believe is on Netflix, if you want to check it out, and then watched Naja 2. So I guess I'll kind of be talking about both, but mostly the second one. This is well worth a watch. This is some of the most, if not the most, visually interesting things I've ever seen on screen. They are doing concepts and big ideas, and then just putting them on the screen for you to gasp at. A lot of the box office for this was made on big screens in 3D. I'm sure that I haven't seen it in 3D, but I'm sure the 3D works really well. I only saw it at a 2D showing. I was blown away by this. I will say, don't start with two. I think it's really important to see one. It really is a sequel. I think you kind of have to know what happened in the first one to appreciate the story elements of what's happening in the second one. And that's the other place where I think it really succeeds. I think it certainly has some fetch questiness to it. Like, there's, you know, like three big bads that he has to take on before he can do the ultimate thing, you know, like that kind of stuff. Mm. But story wise, there's a really interesting thing going on here with what it means to be a monster, how we make monsters of people, and what it, you know, what determines whether somebody is good or bad or a monster or a hero. Seed of the premise is that there was a pearl that was divided into two, and one side was the demon pearl and the other side was the spirit pearl. And the spirit pearl was supposed to be given to the third son of this amazing couple, and due to some trickery, they were given the demon pearl instead. And so their child has the demon pearl in them, not the spirit pearl. And then what happens with the spirit pearl goes to this son of another race of dragons. And, you know, they become kind of the frenemies of this series. Anyways, I really had a blast with this. I think it's well worth watching, subbed or dubbed. When it comes to animation, I think they do a pretty good job with the dubs, in my opinion.
Where
so,
did you find it?
The first one's on Netflix, I think, and the second one is still in theater, or was still in theaters when I saw it. So,
gotcha.
And probably will be coming to streaming soon. But man, some of this stuff is, I truly believe, is going to blow your mind. I think it's really good.
It is fascinating how different our tastes can be due to our location on the planet and our culture
sure.
around us. And this is neither here nor there, but I was just reading yesterday, apparently everyone in Hawaii, no matter what race they are, if you live in Hawaii, you eat Spam 3 times a week. They freaking love Spam in Hawaii. And that's wild to me. Also, it's cheaper in Hawaii than it is here, which is counterintuitive. I've been curious about this as I've been reading about it breaking box office records and whatnot. And of course, over here, it didn't do anything. No one here is talking about it. So,
yeah,
I'm glad to know it's actually good.
And even penetrated my psyche. I had never heard of this before. And I follow a lot of box office news and stuff, and I'll go to Variety, and a lot of times they'll come out and pick out special international hits and stuff like that to highlight, and this one has eluded me. So it's I guess they have a hard time marketing this type of stuff out here for whatever reason, even though there's a huge fan base for this type of thing.
Sure.
So I don't know. I don't know what the problem is, because you've gotten me excited to watch it, and I hadn't even heard of it.
They released it here earlier in the year when it was released in China and didn't do anything. And then after it just kept blowing up in China, they did a re-release. I think they did an IMAX 3D re-release within the last few weeks, and also in some other theaters. So you still can find it, or at least you could last week. It may be out now. I don't know, but but yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be replaced on screens by Spinal Tap 2.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes, that is correct.
All right. I am going to recommend a movie that has a 5.8 on the IMDb currently, and someone on this very panel is also going to disagree with me on this small recommend. It is Spike Lee's Highest to Lowest, which came out on Apple TV over the weekend, and I gave it a whirl because I love Spike Lee movies. I can totally see why people who don't like this movie don't like this movie. Totally get it. There's some very indulgent parts in this movie, especially at the end. And it gets you on the idea that you're about to watch one thing, and then it kind of just goes away from that, and I think it kind of pulls the rug out. But I lived in New York for 2 years, and this movie really tapped into a lot of like very specific New York things that really appealed to me in this, and I really just dug it. And I've always enjoyed how Spike Lee will introduce some sort of cultural cornerstones into his movie that don't really necessarily have anything to do with the plot, but it just kind of like, there's a part where Denzel Washington is like appealing to James Brown and all these past stars for like advice and stuff like that. And I just find that endearing that Spike Lee does stuff like this. But the story is, Denzel Washington is a wealthy record producer. The label in which he works at is about to get sold, but he wants to maintain control and have something and get excitement into music again. It's all become about money. It's all become about how many clicks you can get on Instagram. It's all these type of things. And he has a son that he takes to a basketball practice. It's like one of these, I don't know, like summer basketball school things or whatever. When he comes back, and the whole story is basically him like trying to figure out how to buy some guy's shares so that he can vote against the sale and so that he can retain interest in the company and all this stuff. And then his son gets kidnapped, or he thinks his son gets kidnapped. It's actually his friend Jeffrey Wright's son who gets kidnapped by mistake. And before he knows that it's just that it's not his son necessarily that's been kidnapped. He's ready to go full on. He's going to spend all the money he has to go after to find this kidnapper who has called him. And the kidnapper's played by A$AP Rocky, which is kind of funny. So he's ready to go full on, and then they find out, oh no, it's Jeffrey Wright's son. And then suddenly he doesn't want to spend that $16.5 million that he's been asked to do. And it's like, and Jeffrey Wright's like, well, don't you want to, I mean, you were going to do it for your son, right? Why wouldn't you do it for mine? They both consider each other's sons like their own sons, even, except when it comes to spending $16.5 million for it. I don't want to say too much after this because the movie does kind of change after this point, because you think it's going to be kind of about this, the moral obligation that he has to, should he put the money up? Should he not? All this type of thing. But it quickly gets beyond that. But I just want to highlight one part of this movie that just made me smile, grin ear to ear, because it's such a New York thing. They get on a subway that's heading to Yankee Stadium. And Nick Turturro is playing a Yankees fan on this subway, and there's all these Yankees fans. They're about to play Boston. They're all everybody's clapping. Let's go Yankees! This is something you will see on a subway to Yankee Stadium. People all dressed up in Yankees gear, being loud and obnoxious. It's exactly what it would happen if you're on this train. And there's a whole section here where the kidnapper is trying to get the money, and there's a point where the emergency brake is pulled. And so neither here nor there what happens after this, but there's a point where Spike Lee goes back to the subway specifically to show Nick Turturro and all these Yankees fans going, Boston pulled the emergency brake. Boston pulled the And it's exactly what would go on in this type of situation. And I just loved it so much. There are a lot of parts about this movie that I'm like, Spike Lee has apparently entered his 14th season of The Simpsons phase, where like, here's Rosie Perez playing herself. Here's Anthony Ramos playing himself. And then there's a whole like 5-minute song at the end of the movie. There's a lot of things to dislike about this, but ultimately, I did enjoy this. I did enjoy Denzel, as always. I did enjoy where this story went. I did enjoy all the New York aspects of it. And so it's a 5.8 on the IMDb. It's not winning a lot of people over. It won me over. Really enjoyed it.
I'm not here to yuck anyone's yum. So I will just say there is one moment in this movie where Denzel Washington is watching the news on a flat screen television, and he turns it off, and it does the cathode ray, like, you know, from the outside.
Yeah.
And clearly that means this is a terrible movie. So,
right, it does. It does.
Yeah. That made me laugh. No, I actually think I can also see why people like this movie. I think there's a lot of personality to it. I think Jeffrey Wright can do no wrong. I think he's really good in this.
Yeah.
This movie. Let's not talk about Dean Winters.
Yeah. I thought a well done inside joke on that too, because there's a line from the trailer that everybody points out when he and Jeffrey Wright, Denzel Washington and Jeffrey Wright are in the car. And they're like, you got insurance or something like that. And Jeffrey Wright pulls out a gun. And he's like, it's Jake from State Farm. And that was like a big, huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, he pulls out a second gun. And he says, well, that's Mayhem, which Dean Winters plays Mayhem in the Allstate ad.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. There was a question in the chat that says, do you need to watch the original High and Low to enjoy this? No. The original High and Low, by the way, is fantastic.
Yeah, you should watch that to enjoy cinema.
Yeah, High and Low, the first high, the, well, the, it, this is a remake of High and Low. The first High and Low is really good. It's a heavy procedural movie. Like, this is what happens when the cops do their jobs and do it well. That's basically what High and Low is all about. It's the same story and setup. But it's more about the cops. Now we're in 2025. I don't think Spike Lee wants to show the cops being super professional and great at their jobs. And they're definitely not that good. They're not awful either, but they're not great, especially personified by Dean Winters, the aforementioned Dean Winters. But not required to watch it, but I would watch High and Low before I watch this movie for sure.
Yeah, I think so. I respect and love when directors make choices, and Spike Lee is making choices in this movie, and that's a good thing. It just so happens that a lot of those choices didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I think what it comes down to.
Jeremy, do you have any other reasons why Aaron is wrong?
I haven't seen
There's plenty of those.
I haven't seen the movie. I do have a lot of reasons why Aaron is wrong. Yes. But
he doesn't even have to have anything to do with this movie.
No, just in general.
Just a bunch of other stuff.
Well,
give me a list of things that Aaron is wrong about.
Let me pull up my
on.
Running list of reasons Aaron is wrong.
Anyway, what do you got for
you
me?
You have
Jeremy?
An everything wrong with Aaron list that you go to every once in a while?
I wish I did. If I could pull that up and share my screen right now, it would be amazing, but I don't.
It'd be awesome.
I'm going to talk about a movie I had never heard of until I watched it a few days ago, and I doubt any of you have heard of it, and that's because it made $85,000 at the box office. And it's a 2024 Canadian film called Fitting In, and it stars Maddie Ziegler, who I most remember from Fallout with Jenna Ortega, but she's apparently also in My Old Ass or whatever that movie is called. I haven't seen that yet. So the conceit here, this is a pretty straightforward coming of age movie with a very specific bent, and I'm going to try and use my words carefully here. So her character discovers early in the film that she has MRKH syndrome, which is something that is a rare disorder that happens where a girl does not have a uterus and some other interior parts, and then the vaginal canal is not fully formed. Now, she's 16, she's got a boyfriend, she's about to get sexually active, and that's when she learns all this, and it throws everything into upheaval. She's got male doctors who are really insensitive, and they give her medical devices of certain sizes to try and use over a period of months to make things work. But she doesn't like it. She hates it. And so she's acting weird. They were about to have sex, but now she won't have sex, and her boyfriend ended up dumping her. She thinks her best friend starts making out with him, so they fall out. She also meets a non-binary person, and they have a friendship / curiosity. And other than that, I really wouldn't want to spoil it for you. I think it is a very unique bent. The director herself had this condition. So I'm guessing a lot of what you see in the film rings true to what that is like. The lead actress, Maddie Ziegler, she's just great in this. I would compare it to, and I'm not trying to make jokes, I would compare it to Edge of 17 meets Teeth, only without the assaulty people from Teeth. I really enjoyed it. It's a 96 on Rotten Tomatoes. So I don't think I'm alone. It's only a 6.1 on IMDb, though, so maybe it's not as good as I thought it was, but it was interesting, and it's basically about her trying to decide who she's going to be and embrace that. And so there you go. It's on Stars.
All right. I have not heard of this one either, yet another one that I have to put on the list.
I hadn't heard of it either, and it definitely sounds like something I would enjoy. These coming of age tales are great when they're autobiographical like that, because you really get a sense of the empathy for what someone else's story must be like, and it's one of my favorite things about watching movies.
All right, let's get on to our big recommend, which is The Fifth Element, and it is Aaron's choice. So, Aaron, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so
big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The Fifth Element is a 1997 Luc Besson film that ended up making $267 million worldwide, making it the most successful French art film of all time. Take that, the 400 blows.
That's correct.
The Fifth Element begins in space as a giant ship passes by like the movie thinks it's a Star Wars or something. Mm-hmm. We pan down to the deserts of Egypt in 1914, where an archaeologist is trusting a sleepy Aziz to provide some light. He yells, "Aziz, light!" And Luc Perry marks down that that is happened a dozen times already. Of course, he's not counting the thousands of times I've said it since then anytime I want someone to turn on the lights. At one point, I hoped to name my Google devices Aziz just for this purpose, but then thought better of it once I considered the icky geopolitical implications. Anyway, after a failed poisoning, the ship lands in some robot aliens that look like the battle droids from Star Wars mated with the TikTok robot from Return of Oz come by to retrieve the stones and the weapon, which is identified in about four or five different roll credit moments already as the Fifth Element begins. The robots promise to return in 300 years when needed, and the priest promises to protect the secret until then. We're now in the year 2257, and Earth is scared about a new evil planet that has spawned nearby. Against the counsel of the current priest, Father Bilbo, the president fires on it, and it, of course, only makes things worse. The evil planet sends a skull volcano towards the ship, and the general leaks black ooze from his head as he pulls a full sunshine and basks in the glorious radiation of it all. Back on Earth in Brooklyn, Corbin Dallas, played by Bruce Willis, is waking up, grabbing one of his four cigarettes for the day, letting his cat in, and disarming a druggie who's wearing some camouflage headwear and also has a lack of understanding about how his gun works. He then heads out in his taxi to look for some passengers. Meanwhile, Father Vito Cornelius Baggins is expositioning to the president how the whole Fifth Element thing works. When the robot aliens attempt to make their salvation return, but are stopped by Akhnot and his Mangalore crew, who blow them out of the sky. So much for trusting the robots. Mm-hmm. But a single hand has survived, and apparently has plenty of DNA thingamajigs to do a reconstruction, because it's special or something. So a machine builds the skeleton and then adds the muscles and finally uses solar bombardment to add the skin. And boy, oh boy, it's a woman with orange hair that bears a striking resemblance to Mila Jovovich. Some thermal strips are deployed for the slimmest of modesty's sake before General Monroe can take some pictures. And just like that, the word underboob became an important part of the vocabulary of adolescence in the 90s. The awakened creature speaks in a language no one understands, growls like a lion, and then pulls a Bruce Willis by using the vents to escape. Even though, as far as I can tell, no one asked her to come out to the coast and have a few laughs. She eventually does a Peter Pan from that building right here and survives the crash into Corbin's taxi with a big bada boom. The police arrive, and the woman pleads with Dallas to please help, because apparently she can read English and comprehend what it means and speak it for some reason. Her pleas eventually convince Corbin to make a run for it, and a futuristic chase takes place through various types of McDonald's product placement. He eventually decides to go down through the 3D horizontal traffic to hide in the fog towards the surface. She asks for the priest, Vito Cornelius, and so he takes her there, only for the priest to have a fainting spell because of her totally sick tattoo. Corbin then plants a kiss on the sleeping woman, and who rightfully pulls a gun to his head for not understanding how consent works. Corbin is chased out of the priest's house and heads home to lament his mistakes, but not before he learns her name is Lilu. Lilu, back at the priest's house, is learning the history of everything and eating a very large amount of chicken. But then we meet Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg, played by a very game Gary Oldman, who is finishing up his deal with Akhnot to deliver him the four stones. But after the case ends up being empty, he cancels the arms deal, but leaves them with one crate, knowing that curiosity will kill the Mangalore cats or something. Turns out the stones were entrusted to Plava Laguna, a singer who will be performing at Flossed in Paradise. And this puts into motion a line of incredible coincidences. Turns out Corbin formerly worked for General Monroe, and they've rigged a contest so that he will go to Flossed to retrieve the stones. At the same time, Priest Vito and Lilu drop by to try to convince him to go to the same place. But then the police stop by to arrest the meat popsicle, but get the wrong guy for Zorg. But it doesn't matter because the Ocknot crew is also there to re-kidnap the wrong guy at the same time. So it's time for everyone to try to take the trip to Floston. Vito's assistant David tries first, but Corbin rudely interrupts him and takes the spot with his wife, Lilu Dallas Multipass. Then the Mangalore show up with the wrong face, allowing Vito to sneak in because of the distraction. Now that that's all out of the way, we get to Chris Tucker as Ruby Rod with the greenest of the super green performances as he and his tunnel hair, that is somehow both phallic and yonic, holds court for a few minutes. Vito sneaks into the landing gear, Zorg's guy gets blown up after being the last person to try to imitate Corbin, and the ship goes through its innuendo-laden takeoff routine to head to Floston Paradise.
Head right.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the voice of darkness from the evil planet calls Zorg to check in and give him a cranial oil leak. And it's on to Floston Paradise. Corbin checks in, finds some suits in the wall, and gets a call from his pestering mother. And Lilu is told that Plava Laguna will give her what she came for after the concert. The concert begins with another Ruby Rod extravaganza, and we see that the Mangalores are all nearby ready to attack. Plava Laguna then comes out and does an incredible rendition of Il Dolce Suono as Zorg shows up with his own bid for the stones. The Mangalore crew invade Laguna's dressing room as the opera transitions to a techno bent, and Lilu takes out the entire invading horde with some moves she learned from martial arts and Three Stooges movies. Chaos then ensues as Zorg arrives and the rest of Ocknot's crew go full mutiny on the ship. Zorg grabs the container from Lilu that he assumes contains the stones, but he decides not to check until he's already headed home. Plava Laguna is shot in the melee and in her dying breath tells him, "The treasure is buried in my intestines." He does some post-mortem surgery, retrieves the stones, and then tries to survive the ensuing firefight as Ruby Rod continues to narrate. Dallas finds his way to the control room where he shoots Ocknot in the head, subduing all his army and ensuring no one will ever greenlight a show on Disney Plus called The Mangalorian. Zorg returns to the Floston ship to shut down his third act ticking clock cliche bomb and does so just before realizing that the Mangalores had their own bomb on board, at which he does his best Jeff Daniels in speed impression before blowing up. The good guys head back to Earth with all the pieces in tow, but the evil planet now has its own ticking clock as the Earth will be impacted in just about the time it takes them to get there. Lilu does some quick heartbreaking lessons on war as our crew lands at the temple to do some basic toddler symbol matching in the world's easiest puzzle. But the stones need unlocked. Even after Lilu literally spells it out for them, it takes a sigh from David to help them realize they need to go full Avatar Last Airbender on the stones so that Lilu can do her magic. But in her depressed state from her lessons of the ravages of war, she needs one last motivation in the form of Corbin's love before she can laser vomit the dark planet into a new moon for Earth. The movie then ends as the president wants to thank our heroes, but has to talk to Corbin's mom instead, as Corbin and Lilu are too busy literally embodying the overall message of the movie, make love, not war. And that is The Fifth Element. Guys, what did you think this time through?
Jeremy, what you got?
Fucking Chris Tucker, man. I know Slab just left the chat after praising Chris Tucker in this movie, but Chris Tucker kind of kills this movie for me.
Oh, no way! That's amazing!
I am dead serious. Two-thirds of the way through this movie, I am riveted. I am in it. And then it's not solely Chris Tucker. I think a lot of what happens in the climax is just like the shootout in the casino room thing. That is kind of boring. I do love a lot of the last third, just not the last third in and of itself as a whole. I would even say I love the movie, but no, I think this is about 30% too much Chris Tucker. and I have seen him be 30% less Chris Tucker in many instances, and that would have helped. I get it, and I get why he's the favorite part for many people. I get it. But okay, so the thing I was struck with most this time through, I've seen this movie 8 or 9 times, is the colors, man. The colors pop, the bright oranges and reds, and then the singer blue at the end, and the contrast of the colors all the way throughout the film are just, it's a visual delight. I think Mila Jovovich makes this movie. Bruce Willis is good, but I think plenty of actors could have done the thing Bruce Willis is doing here, whereas Mila Jovovich is singularly adorable in this movie in a way that I'm not sure too many people could have pulled off. She's childlike, and she makes you fall in love with her, not necessarily romantically, although Bruce Willis apparently does. Let's see what else. I'm going through my notes here. I love the world building. The movie is insane, but the universe it's taking place in feels very real. And a lot of what he does well is giving you hints without having to stop and explain every little thing, like the fog. There's a fog at the base of the planet. This explains why they've built up so high and everything flies. We don't know what the fog is. We don't know what caused the fog. I don't need that exposition to know how it fits into this. You know, so it's little pockets like that that build the universe in a way that I think is really rewarding for viewers. I love the subtitle during the car chase. When Lulu talks, the subtitle literally said, "Yelling in a divine language."
Yep.
And I just love when subtitles can make me laugh like that. let's see. Yeah, there's a whole paragraph about Chris Tucker. I already talked about that. So Gary Oldman is fantastic in this. Gary Oldman is always going to be fantastic. But I love really reaching Gary Oldman. He says he based this portrayal off a cross between Ross Perot and Bugs Bunny. Mm-hmm. But there is an all-timer of a line reading at the end of the movie when he opens the case in his ship and starts laughing and eventually spits out, "They're not here." Mm-hmm. And it is maybe one of my favorite line readings of all time, let alone in this movie. He steals every scene that he's in. I wish he was in a few more scenes and Chris Tucker was not. let's see. I think that's basically, I get what you're saying, Aaron, at the end there, that make love, not war, literally in bot, but I don't like them together. Like, I know that the movie does, but no.
There's a good age difference between those two as
yeah,
well. It's pretty insane.
I don't like any of that. I don't like... Well. Anyway, it's Luc Besson. What are you going to do? Like, he's horny. The IMDb says that the first draft of the screenplay he wrote when he was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I think that both explains a lot and is very impressive. Yeah, I love this movie. If you dial back Chris Tucker 20-30%, I might think it's perfect. I don't really have too many negative things to say. Chris?
I would dial Chris Tucker back maybe a little less than you. I liked Chris Tucker quite a bit in this. I think there's some moments in this where I feel like he doesn't need to be with them after the Flosston stuff, you know, like have him take some other ship somewhere else, and then that way he's got that one little moment in the middle and he doesn't have to be with them, because after that, that's where it starts grating a little bit. The screaming and all the other stuff that we've seen, it needs to be a little bit in a like lower dose after that point. Up until the point that they get off of Flosston, though, I'm enjoying Chris Tucker all the way through it. I really, really like it. I can't remember what I thought about this movie when I first watched it. I do remember being at my first movie theater when this came out, and Sony had like two huge, like very, very like out there sci-fi movies coming out in the year. It was this and Starship Troopers. Both came out the same year. And they were, I don't remember The Fifth Element being that terribly big of a hit. Maybe it was, maybe the international box office really, I don't know how much it made domestically, but it was like one of the first, it was like a May movie, Fifth Element. It came out at the beginning of the summer, but I don't remember tons of people coming out to see it. But I really like it now. I think I appreciate it a lot more now than I did back then, for sure. Same thing goes for Starship Troopers. When I watched that the first time, I didn't like it too much. But this one, I think Chris Tucker probably did grate on me quite a bit back in 1997. But he was Chris Tucker, man. This was his year. Like, Money Talks was a big hit after this that came after. And then he was in Jackie Brown later on in the year. So this was a huge year for him. That's what led to Rush Hour. I'm almost certain almost all this that came out. But going over what I was what I liked about this and what I disliked and whatever, I do love Luke Perry being cast to look bored at the beginning of the movie. It cracks me up. It's complete. And you mentioned it in the synopsis, Aaron, complete with him keeping track of how many times the professor says Aziz Light. I really, really enjoyed that. Not that it really matters, but I don't think I understand any of this at the beginning. The aliens come down to get the stones because they aren't safe on Earth, but then they take the stones and arguably put them in even more danger by taking them out of a locked vault that only they have the key to. I don't know if I understand this at all. Maybe it's some sort of comment on, oh, they're about to discover atomic energy and then it's going to blow up in an atomic explosion at some point. I don't know. I don't think I get it, why they take those stones out. They don't really give an explanation. I don't think the movie has an explanation other than plot needs to happen. The stones only work on Earth, too. So, like, if they fail to come back like they say they're going to, then everybody's out of luck, I guess. You know, I don't know if they can use the stones out there wherever they live or whatever, but people on Earth are going to be out of luck because the aliens came down and took the fucking stones. And then they decide to wait exactly the length of time it takes to save the world before they can bring the stones back. I don't think I get any of what happens with the stones here. They're like, well, we were taking them to you, but we don't really trust humans. So we didn't really have the stones on board that ship, but we did have the fifth element and you can recreate her if you want to, blah, blah, blah. Oh, if you want to get the stones, oh, we've stuffed them inside of the diva has stuffed them inside of herself. You've got to go to another planet. She's going to have to, I guess, sacrifice herself if she doesn't get shot and pull these stones out of her body. I don't know if I get any of that plot at all.
Is it birds that use stones for digestion and they can spit them back up? It's probably something like that. She has some sort of, you know, stone stomach.
It's exactly like that. In the chat, Polly saying, nah, she just birthed them. Okay. What if you say so? Then I love Matthew Kasovitz, who plays the mugger at the beginning of the movie. Give me the cash! I love that so much. He made a character that could have been completely forgetful, and he made him very memorable. He's the guy, by the way, in Amelie that Amelie falls for. And he directed a movie called Hate that is really good. Try to find that movie. It's La Haine, or something. I can't pronounce the French one. But he directed a movie called Hate. It's really, really good if you ever run across it. This is Mila Jovovich's best performance ever, easily. If it wasn't for the fact that she was in Dazed and Confused, this would be her best movie, too. It's funny though, a lot of this perfect being stuff in relation to her is kind of embarrassing, but I guess that's what you get when you have a screenplay originally wrote by a 15-year-old.
Wasn't he dating her when they made this movie?
Yeah, I think so. And then they did the passion project, the messenger Joan of Arc after this.
I remember being really excited for that.
Yeah. That crashed and burned. Hey, how did she know she could jump through that foil in the lab? this is one of the random comments I wrote down. I guess we thought I was sending this movie. Gary Oldman is at his 1990s best in this one. There's so many 90s performances that you can group in here. True Romance a few years before. Of course, Leon the Professional by Luc Besson comes to mind as well. This is just Gary Oldman doing a fearless comic performance. I love that gun demonstration all the way through, how he's moving, how he's talking. Everything about that is like a masterpiece to me. I love when Zorg opens the case and there's no stones there, and it just cuts to Lilo going, ah! I love that. Zorg's table that tells him water, fruit, when it comes out to give him the water and the
one
fruit.
One grape.
And, yeah, he grabs something and it says, a cherry.
Yeah, cherry, yeah.
I love it when the cops come by and they got the wrong Corbin Dallas, and the guy's like, smoke you. It's just such a weird thing to say. It's a great different. It's a different kind of like, insult to just say, smoke you. I did write down that Chris Tucker is a scene stealer. I'm glad that I did. I'm glad that I went second on this one, because that was like completely dragged me down to hear Jeremy hate him so much. The whole thing with the ship, you mentioned this too, Aaron, about to take off, intercut with Ruby Rod having sex with the flight attendant, is a little ham-handed, because it feels like they're trying, yes, it feels like they're trying to make that parallel, but then he intercuts it with a lot of other stuff that doesn't really go along with it.
Yeah.
But I do love the fact that he is cutting down to the ground crew, and they're like smoking weed, and they're like burning these little parasites that are in the wheel wells. Mm-hmm. Talk about world building. That's one of those type of things that I think is really fun about the movie. It says there's obviously a lull in the action. We want to get from one place to another. Here's a whole bunch of stuff that's fun and entertaining while you wait for the next bit of action to happen. And I thought that was a really well done scene. Other than just, it seemed a little ham-handed. I love how Corbin's mom somehow discovers how to call him on another planet in his hotel room to continue complaining about him. I thought that was really funny. And finally, I find it extremely hilarious that it takes until the letter W until Lilo learns about war. I know it's unintended humor, but it's funny as hell to me that it takes until W and not like any other number of things she could have run across.
A with atomic bomb, you know.
Right, exactly. Any other number of things that she could have found on that, you know, the alphabet history of the universe thing. I found it's supposed to be a scene where you're being like, oh yeah, she's just now learning about war. Oh my God, there's so much to take. That's like, you know, Alex in the chair and Clockwork Orange almost, you know, she's learning about all this type of stuff. And then you go back and wait a minute. Did she not learn about guns, atomic bombs, different kinds of wars? I mean, like all this other stuff. I think that's hilarious. Anyway, overall, still, I enjoy this movie. I think I have appreciated it more over time. I think it was for a while there, it was just kind of like, that's an okay movie. Now I watch this movie with delight. So there you go.
I think I probably watched this movie 50 times between its, you know, release on, you know, home media on DVD at the time. And then when I, you know, started having kids in the 2000s, I don't think I've seen it since then. Like, I think it's been probably 20 years maybe since I put it in. And it's really amazing to me, as much as I watch this movie, how much I missed with my eyes of 20 years ago. You know what I mean? Like how we change and what we pay attention to and what we see. There are some things that make sense just because I was sheltered or whatever. Like I completely missed the whole thing where the guy's like, you know, the cat comes in and he says he's got a cat and he's like, yeah, you prefer it to the real thing or whatever. Yeah. Completely missed that wordplay in my, you know, until I watched it this time or whatever. And, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff I missed. I'm also focused on a lot more of shot selection and different interesting things. My favorite scene this time through was probably when Cornelius confronts Zorg in his office and they're having this tete-a-tete about whether chaos brings about action more than love or whatever. And it's kind of, again, the central theme of the movie, if there is one. And there's this shot of him breaking the glass where he flicks the glass across the table. And the shot is from the perspective of where the glass is going to fall off the table.
Yeah.
And he just, it's so cool. Like, I'm just like, that's just the perfect shot of that movement. And just noticing stuff like that this time through gave me a little bit of respect for the filmmaking of this movie that I mostly enjoyed earlier because I thought it was creative and the world building was awesome and it was funny and Chris Tucker was amazing, for those reasons. But now I have all these other reasons to love it. And yes, I will talk about Chris Tucker a little bit. I do think he's perfect in this. I think what it is, I actually agree with what you said, Chris, about maybe leaving him on Flosston or having a different exit from Flosston and not staying with our heroes. That might have been better. But man, when he's doing his shtick on Flosston, it's like he was given permission to go like the Super Saiyan version of Chris Tucker, where he just gets to be complete. It reminds me of Ace Ventura in some of those earlier movies where Jim Carrey just gets to be the sun, and just gets to go where he wants to go. And there are very few people who have that dial like that, where they can go that big and be that, in my opinion, entertaining in that way. And so to see him do that here was great. And it's also because the movie feels a little bit like Moulin Rouge, where like it's an elevated reality where you forgive a lot of the over-the-topness and ridiculousness because you know that you're in a very specific kind of movie or specific kind of world. In fact, I think Baz Luhrmann called them like red curtain movies. Like, you know you're watching something. Like, the curtain opens and you get to enter a new reality. Yep. And I think this movie feels like that in the Chris Tucker performance because of that really, really works for me. But yeah, I really loved it this time through. It's very clear to me that Luc Besson has this really interesting brain that can build worlds. I'm not sure. I haven't revisited it. I'm not sure why it works here and not in his more recent one.
Valerian? The title is,
Valerian, Thousand Planets.
It's probably Dane DeHaan. I always blame him.
It might be the casting a little bit, but the world building in it's not terrible. I just this has so much more life to it. Feels so much more, straightforward. I feel like I follow it really well. I don't get confused during this movie as much world building as he's doing. I'm never confused. I had a blast watching it again, and glad to put it on.
Why does he let the cat out overnight, and where is it supposed to go? He lives on the 1,000th floor of a metal building, like. Where's the cat going?
How about that restaurant service, though, by the way?
The
guy has a floating ship that comes over by his window and makes the food there. That's a great idea.
And gives you your mail,
exactly. Said,
I absolutely love the floating noodle cart, but I think that is a terrible business idea, and I would never invest in it. Because you're only serving one customer at a time the whole time, as opposed to customers coming to you. But again, I don't think this is a world where you can walk anywhere, right? Like, there's a fog, so you're going anywhere, you're floating there. So I guess, but it's very cool world building. So I love it.
Yeah,
exactly. All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right, so I thought of, and I'm not going to say any of these in case they are yours, Jeremy, but I'll go straight on to mine, but I'll talk about others that I thought of, and at least one was mentioned before this, but I went with something pretty plot basic here. the fact that we have this giant evil being that's like coming towards Earth needs to be stopped. Thought of Doctor Strange quite a bit on this one. So I felt like Doctor Strange would be a good super secret double feature for this one. You know, Dormammu and all of that. I mean, they don't beat this giant ball of fire like Doctor Strange does, but that very thin plot connection was what gave me the. I thought of a lot of other stuff, but I'm going to let Jeremy go ahead and give his. So.
I will also share some other stuff after I give mine. But I'm pretty set on mine. I'm double featuring a movie that is zany, that has an over the top villain, that has over the top action, that has sci-fi elements, and has someone reluctantly protecting someone else who's vulnerable, who literally landed in their vehicle. I'm going with Last Action Hero.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think the tone, you just mentioned how full of life Fifth Element is. I think the jovial, not a real universe, over the top, everything that's happening, I think those would be a good tonal pair up. But I, mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned Doctor Strange because of something coming to Earth to destroy it. I had Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, written down for a good while there because it's equally zany.
Yeah.
And of course, I think this movie is essentially the sci-fi version of The Professional.
Yeah.
But Last Action Hero was my choice.
Yeah, that's a good one. I totally agree with that one. Aaron mentioned Moulin Rouge, which was one that I had thought of.
Yeah.
Earlier on, just because it's very Baz Luhrmann-esque throughout this thing. I think I've used Moulin Rouge as a super secret double feature before, though, and that's the reason why I ended up not doing that. I didn't bother to research whether I had done Moulin Rouge before, but I felt pretty confident in it enough to not use it. There's also, this must be French filmmaker thing, because there's a lot about this movie that reminded me of the Jean-Pierre Jeunet movies that were coming out in the 90s, City of Lost Children and things like that. Jean-Pierre Jeunet had his own sci-fi masterpiece this year, Alien Resurrection, came out.
Hey, after Alien 3, Resurrection was a step up, man.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But there's a lot of Jean-Pierre Jeunet type of stuff in this, I feel like. The French definitely have, I guess, the Jerry Lewis influence. Like, you've always heard about that. You always hear about that when you grow up about the French audiences. They love them some Jerry Lewis, and it seems like it comes off a little bit in these comedies that you see that come out. I think those were a couple good super secret double features for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Next week's homework. It'll be my choice. It is a movie that I have talked about many times before, but I have never pulled the trigger on making it a big recommend.
Ooh.
It is going to be 1977's Sorcerer, William Friedkin directed. This is a movie that I have really only, even though I've talked about it a lot, I feel like I've only recently, I only recently watched this, maybe 5 years ago, if that, and maybe it was longer, I don't know. But when I first watched it, I had avoided this for the longest time because it still had its reputation from the 70s as a not as good as William Friedkin could do type of movie, because he had done The French Connection, he had done The Exorcist, and this movie was not as good as those or whatever. And I like Sorcerer better than The Exorcist. I don't know if I like it better than French Connection, but I love this movie a lot. It is also a remake. It's not trying to connect to Aaron's Not trying to connect anything to anything. I don't know what I was trying to connect. Maybe I was trying to connect to Highest to Lowest.
Highest to Lowest, I think, is an interesting connection.
But no, this was a remake of The Wages of Fear, which is also a great movie, and I saw it on the big screen in the last year. I prefer Sorcerer, but I think I'm also biased because I saw it first before I saw Wages of Fear. Both of them are very good, though, and so... So, yeah, looking forward to doing that. Have you guys seen Sorcerer?
So, no, this is a list of shame movie for me, and I have a funny story about this, because when you initially recommended this on the previous podcast we used to do, you sold it so hard that it's near the top of my want-to-watch list, and I very nearly, about 6 weeks ago, very nearly made this big recommend without even having seen it, because I'm that confident I'm going to like it. And I wanted an excuse to watch it with intent. And now you have given that to me. I'm very, very, very excited.
Yeah, I've seen Wages of Fear and Sorcerer, and I love them both. I think I agree. It's really close. They're both really good. But Sorcerer, there's especially a couple scenes in Sorcerer that just elevate it to kind of next level for me. So
yeah, there's an added element of tension to this movie that's not... The Wages of Fear still does it. It just feels like there's something about this that it really felt like it was dangerous making the movie. That's where it gets to that point. So, but anyway, looking forward to doing that one next week. I hope all of you guys enjoy it too. Looks like we have time for a question.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What movie score/theme do you think would work well with a totally unrelated movie?
I can hop in on this one. First, I have often said that the greatest score for a terrible movie is the score from Last Airbender. And so I want to find it a nice tome, because that score is amazing. what's interesting is everywhere I think it would be amazing already has a really good score. But I went ahead and went with Crouching Tiger. And I know that score is great, but there's something interesting and, you know, has a lot of grandeur from that Last Airbender score that I'd love to see in a movie like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. So, it is one of my favorite scores to just pop on if I'm in like a movie music listening mode, and it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, so. It's funny. To this day, I still haven't seen The Last Airbender. Sims video was all Jeremy. That was back in the day when we would solo Sims videos, and so I didn't watch The Last Airbender. And I still haven't seen it to this day, but it's a movie that I always hear about having this great soundtrack. So I'm going to have to at least listen to the music at some point, I think. Jeremy, what you got?
I have seen The Martian. Oh God. I have had The Martian on or seen it. We're approaching 75 times at this point in my life. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to end up challenging The Matrix for my favorite movie in a few years. But the score to that movie is really understated, but it's perfect for what you're watching, which is a man on his own trying to figure out how to stay alive. And I think it would work really well under Castaway. And I think I can't really tell you what the score to Castaway is off the top of my head. It's not one that has resonated or stayed with me. It may be a perfectly good score.
It's Alan Silvestri slander. I will not abide.
I'm sure it's perfect for the movie, but I do think The Martian score would work well under another survival type situation like Castaway.
Yeah, it isn't that basic. The Martian is basically Castaway
on Mars.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it would totally work.
A scene where they said, "We had a whole funeral for you," and Matt Damon says, "What was in the coffin?"
There is. Yes.
No, I'm joking.
Absolutely. There is a score that I love. It's actually the last score that Bernard Herrmann ever did. It's for the one for Taxi Driver, which is a very saxophone heavy score that really works well with Taxi Driver for sure. But I thought it and not that I don't like the sound the score to Rounders. Rounders has its own, I feel like, almost iconic music at this point, but I feel like Taxi Driver's music would go really well with Rounders as well. That just that solo sax playing all the way through it and everything. I think the movie would be a little bit more serious than what Rounders is ultimately if he kind of used that music. But there's so many like night scenes in Rounders that I think go that kind of score goes well with and everything. So that's the one that I picked for that.
Excellent.
All right. That is going to, well, hold on. Let's do the real quick. chat says, let's see. Polly says Harry Potter theme over some Christmas movie. Yeah, the Harry Potter theme would definitely fit a Christmas movie. And I always think of Christmas when that John Williams score goes through and everything. So, I agree with that. Castro says the incredible score over Superman this past year, Superman would be a good one. And I'm never going to fight you on Michael Giacchino being on any.
Yeah, seriously.
Movie. James says the stylings of Ratatouille score would fit into Pixar's Luca very well. Polly says Indiana Jones theme over Die Hard. Yeah, that'd be interesting. That would be interesting. And then JC says, I feel like Blade Runner soundtrack might work well with Taxi Driver. And I agree with you on that one. Hmm. I totally agree with that.
Hmm.
All right. That's going to do it for this week. Next week is Sorcerer. Chat, thank you so much for coming out. We appreciate it very much. That's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time.
See
you.
Bye, dudes. Guys.
Bye.
Double salute. Real salute.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Speaking of rookie quarterbacks, or technically second-year quarterbacks, I guess, J.J. McCarthy last night, as a Michigan fan, was nice to see him pull it out in the fourth quarter.
It was funny. He's kind of struggling, and all of a sudden he looked like Tom Brady.
Yeah. I think he
really did have the Tom Brady look and everything.
Yeah, I think that's the easiest comparison, both quarterbacks that won championships at Michigan and then didn't have necessarily a ton expected of them in the NFL and have something to prove, but we'll see. I guess they said on the broadcast that he's only lost three times in his entire career since high school or something like that. Like he's like 66-3 or something. It's like ridiculous. But I imagine there'll be plenty more losses on his docket, over the years, but we'll see.
Oh, sure. But that was an impressive little comeback last night.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun to watch.
Do you root for college teams at all?
Sort of. Like when I was growing up, I went for, I'm from Tennessee, so I will root for Tennessee.
Oh, right. So.
So Tennessee, UT is technically my college team. But I don't ride them to the point of, it's going to ruin my day if they lose or any of that type of thing. I kind of snapped out of UT fandom 20-something years ago. I'm not a big college football fan, but I will watch it. I'll generally root for Vanderbilt and UT and hope that they do well, but it doesn't affect me if they lose.
Right. Yeah. Jeremy, you have any college teams?
No. I mean, when I was in middle school and high school, because of where we lived, I was a massive Indiana Hoosiers fan. And that happened to coincide with them winning the national championship with Keith Smart hitting that jumper.
Yeah.
In Indiana, it's a basketball state, and you either root Purdue or IU. But, once I left and went to college, no. Honestly, I don't want to hijack this conversation, but I think school spirit is really fucking stupid, and I don't understand 55-year-old men like rooting on the team where they went to school 30 years ago. It doesn't make any damn sense to me at all.
What about 50-year-old men who root on a team they never went to school at? Is that better or worse?
It's better, Aaron.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yep. So I root for the Orioles because I lived in Baltimore. I was Orioles adjacent, right? Like, when I was in high school, I never felt the need to go to the game on Friday night and cheer on the guys who picked on me every week.
Right. Like, yeah, totally.
The fact that I am confined to this school with you does not give us any kind of bond. I'm not attached to you. You just live near the school like I do, and that's all it is.
I think rooting interest itself is all made up, clearly. You know what I mean? But somehow it stands in for this evolutionary tribal thing that it's hard to shake as a human being, where it's like, you know, I have to have some sort of team to, you know, like, this is my team and we're the best, and, you know, kind of thing. And so it's you find ways to plant it on these completely unimportant things, you know. And it's all made up. This is why anytime there's gatekeeping about who can and can't be fans of something, it blows my mind. Everybody has a stupid made up reason to be a fan of something.
You talking about the people who picked on me or whatever, going on to root them on and all that stuff. I wouldn't say I got picked on too much. I mean, probably because I was, you know, 6'4" in high school.
Yeah, same.
I mean, that didn't stop people from doing that. You know, they didn't stop it. You know, if you were on a football team or whatever, you had this natural, like, you know, I don't know, natural bulliness to you if something went wrong, went sideways. And I got a taste of that because I wrote for the school paper. And when you are, and I think I was 17 when I was writing for this paper, you know, I got put on sports because I was a sports person and blah, blah, blah. But there are a number of things wrong with me writing an article about high school football. Number one, I did not go to the game. Number two, I found out about what happened from the notes that somebody on the team took or whatever. And three, I needed an editor bad, someone to tell me, are you sure you want to write this way? And none of that came to fruition. And I wrote this one article because a guy on our team scored 4 touchdowns. So I was like, oh, all right. You know, this guy, you know, I said, you think of football as a team sport, but this guy did it all, you know, just, you know, because obviously only the running back has any accolades when he scores touchdowns. It's not the offensive line or anything like that. And, but I wrote that and nobody came around to me to say, hey, you know, you might want to, you know, spruce up the rest of the team or not say something about one guy doing it all or whatever. And it got published that way. And I remember vividly walking out of gym one day, walking around a corner, 2 football players that were sitting by a corner. They saw me. And they just rained, you suck, you suck, you suck, right at me as I walked past them.
Jesus. High school's awful. I didn't watch any football. I just happened to notice that he had like 5 or 6 touchdowns or something obscene.
He did. That was a stupid game. That Steelers-Jets game. The Vegas line was 38 was the over-under. 38 points total between the teams. And then they ended up scoring like 70 or something like that between them. So 66, I think, is what it ended up being. And, like, you know, Justin Fields, who can't really throw passes, suddenly was throwing passes like he was Tom Brady all of a sudden. This is the second Tom Brady reference of the outtake. but, you know, this is the other thing that happens after week one is that all summer I've been hearing like fantasy football experts say this and 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 this. Now week one has happened and suddenly oh, we were so wrong about this and that and the other thing. And I'm just like, guys, do you not remember like every week one in history? Like, weirdest things happen on week one. First off, the offenses are not ready to go in week one. They've not really been playing the entire preseason, especially now that they added the 17th game and preseason's three games, and they don't play their starters that much.
Or at all sometimes.
And then they go out week one, and guess what? This game is much faster and more ridiculous than it was in the preseason, and you haven't played it in almost 7 months now. So, like, oh, we were so wrong about this guy, or this is definitely the role this person has, and whatever. And like, guys, you cannot make definitive statements after week one. You just can't. It's the same every year. And I'm sitting here playing fantasy football going, well, who should I overreact to over this past week that I might want to put in my lineup? And how many people should I just keep and just see how they do and not worry about week one? It's going to be, there's going to be a frenzy for a couple of players over the weekend. So,
well, as a Lions fan, it was an interesting overreaction weekend because you come out of the game and you go, oh, we're going to be terrible this year. Guess Ben Johnson was everything. And then Monday night comes and Ben Johnson can't score a touchdown after the first half. And it's like, oh, maybe it wasn't the loss of Ben Johnson. Maybe we're going to be okay. It's just like, it's so much overreaction.
It takes time. And like, yes, the coordinator situation in Detroit is probably going to affect things a little bit, but look at the people you have on the field.
Right.
I mean, it's just kind of, you're probably not going to be as nobody, even with Ben Johnson this year, you weren't going to be as crazy as last year.
Yeah.
You weren't going to, that's
last
almost
year was fun.
Unrepeatable.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's hard after 1 week to just be like, oh, I got to stay calm. But that's the human nature, isn't it?
Well, and it's also that thing where every single team is either undefeated or hasn't won a game.
Yes.
So it's like you're either the best possible record or the worst possible record. Mm-hmm. So everybody's overreacting for sure.
Yeah.
So they're going to make another Vin Diesel Witch Hunter movie?
Looks like it.
And another one?
And dude's coming out of retirement?
Yeah, it's good enough to get Michael Caine out of retirement?
To be in the last Witch Hunter 2?
Yeah, I don't get it either.
Did the first movie even make any money?
I don't think it was a hit. I mean, it could be a streaming hit for all I know.
Is this one of those things where they're just like, well, we've got this IP and we don't have to pay for it, so let's make something with that? Is that what's going on here?
I've come to the conclusion that there are so many shady things going on in movie world about how they finance things and what they do to justify the things that they do and all this other stuff to think that, yeah, someone's going to make money here. It's whoever is. There's going to be a person. There's going to be a person or a group of persons who will make money off of Last Witch Hunter 2 being made.
The first one was an international hit, apparently. It only made like 27 here, but it made like 119 worldwide or something.
That'll do it.
146 total on a 90 million budget.
Especially if it didn't cost much to make.
Yeah. It was huge in Belgium.
Yes, huge in Belgium.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply in-app only.